call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Clerk will take the role. First order of business would be to approve the minutes of the last meeting, if I could have a motion to do that. Representative Bly moves the approval of the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
As opposed?
No.
Duly noted, Representative Thompson. We do have a full agenda today. Hearing from the Public Utilities Commission and a presentation on the wind integration study. Also from a representative from the Public Utilities Commission, and hopefully we'll have time to get into some other transmission issues. But we will begin with the presentation from Dr. Beryl Haar, the Executive Secretary of the Public Utilities Commission, who will kind of give us an overview of the responsibilities and activities of the Public Utilities Commission. So welcome to the committee, Dr. Haar, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Beryl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. You should have in your packet a one-page sort of outline of the points I'm just going to cover briefly today in talking about the Public Utilities Commission and what it is and what it does and so on. Also, a little more detailed report will also be distributed that goes into just a little more detail about the individual commissioners, a little bit about their background, and a little more detail about our operations. So, I will be talking about the PUC, obviously, and Ken Wolf, the Reliability Administrator with the Commission, will be providing an overview on the wind integration study. Well, first of all, what does the Commission do? What does the Public Utilities Commission do? Fundamentally, the Commission regulates three cornerstone services in the state of Minnesota: local telephone service, retail electricity, and retail natural gas services. The basic mission is to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable service at fair and reasonable rates. That's right out of the statute. Also, in 2005, the legislature transferred to the Public Utilities Commission authority over the siting and routing of large energy facilities, generation, electric generation plants, transmission lines, natural gas pipelines, petroleum pipelines, large wind conversion systems, and so forth. What is the structure of the commission? The commission is made up of five members. They're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. No more than three can be from any one party at any point in time. Also, the commission is deliberately structured to have a significant degree of independent decision-making authority. Disciplined decision-making is really the commission's stock in trade. It's fundamentally what the commission does. It's a decision-making body. And as I said, it's the statutes are structured in a way to provide for a significant degree of independence in carrying out that function. And to help ensure the integrity of that decision-making process, the commission is also held to specific standards of conduct. For example, all the commission deliberations must be in a public meeting. We're subject to the open meeting law, like many boards and commissions. Decisions must be based on record evidence arrived at through due process. They must be recorded in a written order, which incorporates the rationale for the decision. And, of course, the commission's decisions are subject to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And there are other requirements or restrictions placed on commissioner conduct, again, all of which is intended to ensure the integrity of the commission's decision-making process. How does the commission carry out its responsibilities? Through a structured and disciplined decision-making process, the commission adjudicates party-to-party disputes It establishes rates and terms of service for its jurisdictional companies, and it establishes industry-wide rules and policies. Also, the Commission tries to provide a forum for discussion of topics of broad interest to energy utilities and telephone companies. Also, the Commission mediates consumer complaints concerning services of telephone companies and energy utility providers. Commission's role is somewhat unique in state government in that we have elements of all three branches, judicial, legislative, and administrative. The Commission is a quasi-judicial body when it adjudicates party-to-party disputes and establishes rates and terms of service for its jurisdictional companies. When it establishes broad rules that apply to an entire industry, which it does, it's acting as a legislative body, and it's subject to similar kinds of requirements. The Commission also has the authority to investigate, to resolve consumer issues, and to enforce statutes, so it has administrative authority as well. Public Utilities Commissioners currently on the Commission are Leroy Copendryer, who is the chair. Chair Copendryer, by the way, is in Mississippi as we speak, helping to build housing for Katrina victims. Phyllis Reha, Commissioner Marshall Johnson, Commissioner Penn Nicolai, and Commissioner Tom Pugh. And the handout, the report, that I, a little more detailed report, has, as I said, a little more detailed information about them. Commission staff is, we have 36 staff members, consisting of financial analysts, economists, statisticians, attorneys, mediators, consumer mediators, administrative people, information technology folks. Our budget is $4.2 million. That's our operating budget. A few years ago, the Michigan Public Service Commission did a study of all commissions across the country, and they looked at commission staff and budget size on a per capita basis. In that study, Minnesota ranked 48 out of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia. So we think Minnesotans are getting a pretty good deal in terms of regulatory costs. And even if you double that to reflect our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, we'd still be in the bottom 20%, far below comparably sized states. And I will conclude by saying that just about 100% of our costs are recovered through our assessment process and returned to the general fund. That's all I have to say in my presentation. I'd be happy to try and answer questions, Mr. Chair.
And are there questions, members? I'm sure there will be a number of them as the session proceeds, Mr. Haar. And maybe there will be some also as we get into the presentation on wind integration study. But if there are no further questions at this time, then Mr. Wolf, if you would like to identify yourself and explain what's been going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me all right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Ken Wolf. I'm the Reliability Administrator working in the Public Utilities Commission. And it's my pleasure to present to you the outcome of this study, which we have spent 18 rigorous months on, spent some $700,000 of ratepayers' money on, and I think you'll find it very interesting. Mention up front here, I have Matt Scherger's name on here. Matt Scherger was the technical advisor to me on this. He's a engineer, a brilliant man, and really kept this thing on task and ushered it through. Unfortunately, he's out of town today, or he would be with me. He's usually my pacifier. I need him for comfort, but I'm on my own today. I want to start out, I'm going to spend not a lot of time, but a fair amount of time setting up this study, because I think it's really, really important that you understand the rigorous process we went through in order to appreciate the end results. The legislative directive was really in two parts. The first part was it directed the reliability administrator, which happens to be the position I hold currently within the Public Utilities Commission, to do a study on the impacts on, number one, reliability, and number two, the costs associated with increasing wind capacity to 20% of retail sales in Minnesota by 2020. The legislative directive was 20%. The second part of the directive was not directed toward the reliability administrator. It was directed to the utilities. It's the second bullet, which says the utilities have the obligation to take the results of this study and to estimate the impact on rates by individual utility and to incorporate that rate impact in their integrated resource plans. An integrated resource plan is a complicated process they go through every several years to forecast and project the resources they're going to need to meet their service requirements to their customers. So that was the two parts. We were to direct the study to determine costs. The utilities were to translate that into rate impacts. I'm going to address both pieces today. You have in your handouts the first piece, and we'll pass off the second piece when I get to that point. The first really important step in this process is we put together, first of all, I hired Matt Sugar as a consultant, and we put together a draft scoping document. The directive was pretty open. What's the reliability and the cost of 20% wind? So we put together a draft document to say specifically what kinds of processes we wanted the consultants to follow and what kinds of issues we wanted to address much more specifically than that general directive. We brought that before all the stakeholders that were interested in coming to the party, and I've listed generally those here. The Minnesota utilities, obviously, who have to deliver whatever when the legislature directs them to deliver. The legislators, key on that were Representative Hackbarth and Senator Anderson. Business interests represented by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Many environmental organizations, Fresh Energy, Wind on the Wires, you name it, they were invited to participate in this process. And then a number of kind of professional national organizations, excuse the acronyms here, but I'll briefly go through them. AWEA is the American Wind Energy Association. National Association represents wind interests. UWIG is the utility wind interest group, representing utilities in the wind industry. NREL is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. It's a national laboratory out of Denver, Colorado, and associated with the Department of Energy. And the ORNL is Oak Ridge National Laboratory, another think tank out of Oak Ridge National Lab, associated and funded by the Department of Energy. So those people represent the best minds you can find in wind and energy technology. Now, as a result of that, a number of things were adjusted as a result of that meeting we held about 18 months ago, I believe. But the main thing is the legislature told us that, look, the language says 20%, but we didn't really want you to stop at 20%, because if you find that 20%, there was a theory at that time that at some point you're going to have a hockey stick effect, you'll run off the edge and you won't be able to achieve that at any cost. We didn't know where that was. So we said, well, look at 20%. In case you can't get there, let's look at 15%. And in case that's not challenging enough, let's look at 25%. So the legislative and the technical review committee or the scoping committee, all interests in there, agreed, let's do it that way. We looked at these discrete points, 15, 20, 25. Each point you look at takes extensive computer runs and modeling and simulations. And so you don't just do 15 to 25%. It would have been cost prohibitive. So we looked at the street point, 15, 20, 25%. The next step in this said, okay, that's okay, we put it out to bids. There were two qualified bidders. We selected the one that we'd worked with before. that had done a previous study on Xcel Energy's footprint, only looking at basically 10% of energy sales. So we selected the vendor. Then we determined that it was, you know, we could go through this expensive study and put the results on the table, and if it didn't have credibility in the stakeholders community, it wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on. So we put together a very highly qualified team of experts. First of all the utilities had a, not all of them, but the major utilities had an engineer on this technical review committee. We invited a representative from Seabed, an engineer. We invited, again, the national interest, the National Renewable Energy Lab. We brought in the best minds in the business, names that you may or may not recognize, but Charlie Smith, Michael Milligan, Brian Parsons, and a few others. World-renowned experts. They present in international conferences on wind. We invited these people to town four different times over this 18-month period. They came in. We started at 8 o'clock in the morning, went to 5 o'clock at night. The vendor would present the methodology, take input from these people, adjust the methodology, decide to look at some other aspects, made some key decisions as to what path we take from here to there. Very, very rigorous examination of every issue, and got very broad consensus from everybody that you're going in the right direction. We would interview and review the interim results, and some of the, you know, say that doesn't seem to follow what we kind of expected to see, so they would debate it, do some more adjusting, and do some more runs, and come back again and run it over and over again. The reason I really emphasize this is that I can tell you without any fear of contradiction that you can take this study and these numbers based on the assumptions which I've documented, very important, based on these assumptions, you can take these numbers to the bank. You will not get a reputable source disputing these numbers. They're solid. These are cost numbers. These are not rate numbers. I'll get into that later. The key assumption. The first one is this assumes a certain transmission network being in place in 2020. It's not in place today. So what this study says regarding that is that if this transmission is in place, and it's documented in Appendix A of the study, and I believe you have that in your packets. It very specifically lists primarily CapEx 2020 lines, but some other lines. And it says, we put these lines into the model, and we have these results. And we have no congestion issues and stuff, assuming this transmission network. It does not say, if you take this one out, it doesn't work. Or if you replace this one with that one, you have to start with some assumptions, you input the model. The reason we assumed those assumptions, again, it was part of the technical review committee with all utilities involved and the national experts. That appendix is taken out of a MISO study, the West RSG study, I think is the technical name, which came up with this plan as a reasonable picture of what the network may look like in 2020. That's a very important part of the assumption. It assumes the transmission's in place. It also assumes that the MISO market, and I'm not going to go in, I think you're going to get some background on MISO, so I won't go into that. MISO is the Midwest Internal System Operator. They basically have control over the power lines in I think it's a 10 or 12 or 14 state area, including Minnesota. And that's a very important part of this, because the reason the numbers come out the way they come out is that we have this huge network to spread the risks and balance and to sell the wind or anything else over and to use it as a major market. Very key assumption. Another key assumption is that the wind that we model, and I'll get into that, I have a map on here from the next slide, is spread over a broad area throughout the Midwest. It's not all in Buffalo Ridge. It's not all in Minnesota. It's northern Minnesota, it's South Dakota, it's North Dakota, and I'll show you precisely where the modeling represented that wind in a minute. And the other thing that's very important is that this whole network is controlled functionally by a single balancing authority. What do I mean by that? NSP has their own balancing authority. They serve their load and manage their resources, or are responsible for their resources. Minnesota Power has theirs. Otter Tail Power has theirs. Other areas have theirs. This says that by 2020, that these are functionally under control of a big brother that has control over all these resources. So when the wind varies, they can go here or there across this huge network at market prices and manage that. That's a very key assumption to the cost that you will see. The dispersion of the energy or the towers, I don't know how well you can see this. Hopefully, I think you have it in color, I hope, in your handout. You'll see the dots spread around North Dakota, South Dakota. High concentration here in Buffalo Ridge. That's just in here. Minnesota part, but this goes into South Dakota. We have some up here on the range. We have some out here in North Dakota, a little bit down here in South Dakota. This was based on extensive discussion by the Technical Review Committee as to where the wind resources are and the practicality of bringing them to market and those sort of issues. That's a key assumption, and part of that is because it disperses the wind and it makes it less variable because, you know, as the front goes through, it doesn't hit all of our wind at one time. If you look closely at this, and you probably can't see it here, the red dots, if you look at your map, are either existing towers or contracted for or under contract. They're real. They're not speculative. Basically, what we have here is 152 dots, I believe, and I think they represent about a 40-megawatt farm in each of those dots for something like 600 or 6,000 megawatts of nameplate capacity of wind towers spread throughout this region. Now, key findings, and we're pretty good on time yet, I think. What this study said, based on these assumptions, vetted by the best experts in the nation, probably internationally, we can clearly manage 25% reliability at some cost. The second bullet is the cost. This is cost, not rate. This ranges from a low of $2.11, I'm going to explain this in better detail, per megawatt hour, which was the low end at 15% wind energy, to a high in the study of $4.41 per megawatt hour at the high range of 25% penetration. And I'll show you a slide which shows this graphically better in a minute, but an interesting part of this study is that we looked and did down to 5-minute runs on every 5-minute increments for 3 years. It's in this model, actual historical data kept by the National Renewable Energy Lab or whatever, and did these modeling and some simulations based on 5-minute increments throughout 3 years. And we found that the results are quite different if you look at 2002 versus 2003 versus 2004. And we found that it was important not to try and average all of this, but to keep a range so you could see some range from high to low. So we did a low for 2002, 2003, 2004, and a high cost for each of those years. And so all I was summarizing here is that $2.11 happened to be the lowest cost one, happened to be at 15% penetration, which would seem intuitive. The highest one was $4.41, and that happened to be at 25% penetration. So there's a correlation there, but it isn't one for one, which you'd have to go into the details of the study to see there's variations in there. We determined that it was important that people understood this is a range, not an average. The last important key finding here, there's lots of findings, but this is very important to remember what integration cost means, what that $2.11 means, what that $4.41 means, and what it does not mean. The integration cost includes the cost of additional reserves that you can't sell because of the variability of wind, which turned out to be a very small piece of this number, by the way, and also reflects the cost impact of the operational effects of the variability and uncertainty of wind. Now, by variability, I mean the fact that the wind varies. Pretty easy to understand. The uncertainty is a little different thing. It means that when I look at what I think I'm going to have in wind tomorrow, that's uncertain. Because in planning the resources and scheduling this and costing it, what the operation engineers do is they say, I think tomorrow I'm going to have this much load, air conditioning, whatever. I'm going to need this much resource. I'm going to get this much from wind. Therefore, I'm going to get this much from coal, nuclear, whatever. When tomorrow comes, because of the variability of wind, it won't be 100% accurate. Much more accurate than a lot of people think, but it won't be 100%. This cost and the cost I'm giving you take all of that into consideration. The fact that wind goes up and down during the day, and the fact that it's not 100% predictable tomorrow. And so tomorrow, when I get too much, I got to sell it or burn or waste it. If I don't have enough, I've got to buy on the MISO market, and that's why the size of the MISO market is very crucial to these numbers. It presumes that MISO market is there. Pages are coming from pass out the rate one now. This is the final slide of the cost impact. I want to remember that demarcation. This is just a kind of a summary. We did in 2002-03 the study for Xcel Energy's footprint only and said they had to get 15% of capacity through wind. That equates to roughly 10% of sales to get apples to apples here, and I show that in the legend at the bottom. Xcel 10% is the right hand tower. The other bars are the things I talked to you about. The yellow is 15% penetration cost. The red is 20%, and the blue is 25%, and it lays out all those numbers. And the interesting thing here is that you can go 25% at less cost statewide than you could do at 10% for Xcel Energy only. The reason being, when you group all this and you have the whole, you don't need as big a percentage of reserves in case you don't meet your forecast. And the utilities have that whole market to go out to and buy and sell energy now. And they can do it cost effectively. So, again, the MISO market and large footprint is crucial to understanding the results of this study. If you change that, I don't know what happens to study to assume the MISO market and the MISO footprint and the transmission that we modeled.
So, Mr. Wolf, is this a good point to stop for questions before you get into the second part of the presentation?
Sure.
I have a couple of questions, one relating to the MISO market, and the question of what kinds of assumptions were made about the nature of that market. For instance, if we're talking about 12 or 14 states or parts of them, were we assuming that they might be doing the same thing as we're contemplating in Minnesota, for instance?
That's an excellent question, and I'm going to just briefly address that, but I'm not the expert on it. The answer is no. MISO is addressing the Senate Thursday. I think you might hear a little bit about that today from utilities, I'm not sure, and I strongly urge you to bring the MISO experts in to hear sometime to get a detailed explanation of that. But no, one of the things that you do have to look at is to go further, which is outside of my scope. But while this is fine, this is based on Minnesota going to whatever level, what if Wisconsin goes to 30%, or what if the nation goes to 20%? The national goal for AWEA, the American Wind Energy Association, is just 20% nationwide. And I can't tell you whether it would be good or bad or up or down. No, this looked strictly at Minnesota sales. But the sources are outside of Minnesota. But it did not look at that aspect of it. And something that there's better minds that can speak to that, than particularly the MISO guy who participated in the study and did most, a lot of our simulations.
And also, Mr. Wolf, I'm sure we'll get into this in more detail when we hear from others, including MISO, but as far as the investment in transmission to make this feasible, could you give us at least a little view of what that would be, what's required?
I would rather the utilities address that. Again, the specific lines are in your handout and are in the study.
Right.
But I'd rather leave that to somebody who understands it a lot better and address it specifically.
Okay.
But I will point out one thing. That transmission network is not unique to wind. We need to do major upgrades to the transmission network to deliver energy to the load. And so it's not unique. The variability piece that I just discussed is unique to wind. It's the variability of wind. But it's like looking at other things that are unique to fossil fuels or that are unique to nuclear or whatever. And we made no attempt to try and compare new coal to wind or to anything else. This says the fact that wind is variable, you should add this increment someplace in your analysis.
Are there other questions for Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Wolf, just to be clear then, upgrades to the transmission system, because the sense is it has to happen anyhow, is not a price that's built into the wind integration study. Is that what I just heard? To be clear.
It is not a price that's built into the wind integration study.
Right.
Now, whether you would need the same or more or less for something else, I can't comment on. It's beyond my scope of the study. But you're right. The transmission is not built into this, just like capital investment of turbines is not built into this.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative?
I do. Actually, it's a different question, but if I may. Mr. Wolf, on page 8 of the end, the summary of the 2004 and 6 studies, and I'm sorry, I had to step out for just a second. Could you tell us why, what's the big difference, again, between 03 and 04?
I'm glad you asked that question.
Mr. Wolf.
03 looks pretty expensive. It looks like is the more recent we get, the more in line the costs come.
Right, and I'm really glad you asked that question.
You're welcome.
Point that out. It has nothing to do with recent.
It doesn't. Okay.
No. What it has to do with is that it turns out the closer the wind pattern for a particular year matched the load requirements for that particular year, the less the cost of integrating it. Mm-hmm. So if the amount of wind you had followed closer to your need for air conditioning or whatever, the less the cost of integrating it was. In the year where the wind was less available compared to your load requirements, so if you had high load and low wind, the costs were more expensive. And the scientists who did this would really like to see 10 years or more years and can refine this. It will keep refining this issue. But it's based on how it happened to match the wind resources versus the need requirements in that particular year.
That leads to another question. Maybe this is for Mr. Harl. You asked us, Mr. Wolf, not to average. These weren't averages. But we're looking, it looks like 03, the wind blows where it wills, and our load demand didn't line up quite as well as they did in 04 and 05. When we're asking the ratepayers to expect this, maybe this is a PUC question, is this going to be an issue? Will we be averaging when we're trying to build it into rates or rate cases are being filed, or you follow my where I think my question's going?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byrd, the circumstances are going to vary from utility to utility, certainly. Mm-hmm. This is a broad aggregate based on all utilities in Minnesota. So it's you have to look at it in the proper perspective. How this translates to rates would be worked out through the general rate-making process, and any additional costs would be taken into account in that process. The extent to which that would have an impact on final rates would depend on what else is involved in the rate case process. It's not, it looks at everything.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We had Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested, too, in the numbers, and Representative Byrd asked a question I was going to ask also. But in Mr. Wolfen, looking at the your key assumptions here, you say a geographically dispersed wind scenario to reach the 20% level I believe we're looking at is our goal here. I'm trying to understand this also. I know the wind resources down there in the southwest corner are the best probably in the state. And if you looked at just developing that, and I understand your answer earlier was that you have different weather patterns across the state and you have a broader geographic base that affects that, but I think that all the wind maps I've seen, and I live down there, I know the wind. It don't seem like the wind blows every day, but it sure feels like it. But we've got the best resources down there, and to me it only makes sense that if we're going to focus on trying to meet some of these challenging goals I see out there, that we'd look at capturing the greatest area of resources in going forth with that. Now, is part of this transmission lines, Ken, or is a part of it the difference in weather across the state, or how? I'm not quite following along how your assumption is put in place here.
This is where I think I give you a pretty good answer to that, and I wish I had Matt Sugar here, who spent a lot of detail on modeling. I think what these dots represented was the maximum. But if you put all of these on if you have all these available and you can deliver it, this is the cost. And I think we geared this down to the 20% line was using a smaller part of this, and the 15% was a smaller part of that. I don't know exactly how the technical review committee spread that. Like, if they went, I don't think they went, let's get the best ones first and then the next one. We said, here was our goal. Let's assume we're there. What's it do? And they modeled the wind at each of these things. The colors on this, by the way, represent wind speeds at these various levels, and yellow shows your best wind. It's kind of a general answer, but.
Just to follow Mr. Chairman and Mr. Wolf, as we try to reach these challenging goals ahead of us here, we have to look at the economics of this, not only for the ratepayers and everything else, but we have to look at it, I think, in a realistic manner about who's going to put the turbines in and how we're going to do this. And as I understand it, when you look at the capability of wind generation here in the areas, and you move to areas of the state that are not conducive to wind power, certainly the economics of building the turbine and having that work comes into play, because someone in the end of this, if we're going to reach 20% or 25% or whoever's got the leading bid, last bid in the auction here, gets up here, in the end of the day, someone has to put the turbines in. Someone has to make them pay for themselves. And that's a challenge a lot of my folks back home are facing today, Ken, is they're looking at the economics of this and saying, whoa, wait a minute. With the cost of turbines now and substation and copper and everything else, it's just not cash flowing for me. And that's in the area of the state where we have tremendous wind resources. And I think if you move out of that, then you put another obstacle, another hurdle up there we have to leap over is, hey, if it doesn't work down here in the Buffalo Ridge, how's it going to work over here when we've got less resources? So I want to know your thoughts about how this fits into our goal, to make a realistic goal.
I really can't answer that question.
That's too old.
That to me is a policy decision. Is how you get there and at what rate and what speed. I think MISO, I know, is going to address some of this on Thursday as far as how fast can they get there based on availability and stuff. And they don't know how fast yet, but they will address that issue. That, to me, is outside of the scope of the science of this study and gets into policy. Where do you distribute it? Who benefits? When do they benefit? Who pays? Et cetera.
I think we have Representative Kalin next on the list.
Mr. Chair, my questions have been asked and fairly sufficiently answered.
Very well, then, Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Considering the spatial and temporal variability across the entire MISO queue related to wind, mm-hmm. as you're presenting, is there, you know, talk of like a good wind year, a bad wind year, if you will, in out in the country with, oh, this is a good wind year or it's a bad wind year. I've heard talks about mentioning of that in people I talk to, developers who are interested in putting up turbines. But in an average wind year, can you tell us how much the wind varies across the MISO footprint? And if it does or does not vary, if it's a couple percentage points. And then the next part is the length of forecasting. What is the confident number amount of time prior to the purchase of the wind, whatever level is required, how many hours out can you confidently say it's going to be this, there's going to be this much wind in Lincoln County at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, January 20th, or whatever it is? Because, you know, Paul Douglas tells me it's going to snow next week. I'm just wondering.
Dave Dahl will tell you.
You know what I mean? They're competing on what's going to happen and who you're going to watch, who you're going to believe. So just, you know, getting up and buying wind first, how much is there? I mean, is it a 24-hour forecasting? I thought I heard that the Western MISO does 24-hour forecasting for wind availability. Can you comment on the average wind year, the variability, and then the confidence that we have in forecasting? And is it getting better?
Esther Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't. And we would get a lot closer if I had Matt Sugar here today. Unfortunately, I didn't, and I would... We would be more than happy to come back or to meet with any group or individuals you want to discuss those issues. We have a more detailed technical presentation, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the kinds of questions you really need to sit down one-on-one with an engineer.
All right.
And I'd need to bring Matt Sugar with me.
Just to follow up. So then, is it in the wind integration study in some chapter or section you could refer me to?
Yeah, I can't refer you to it exactly. If you really want to get into detail, go to Volume 2.
I have.
You already have.
Just wanted you to tell me.
I can't say.
Well, before we get to the situation of having to have you back just to present the second half of your presentation today, Representative Johnson, I think you had a question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I need to make your time last one. However you want to plan it. I need about a good 5 to 10 minutes on the rate part if you want me to cover that, so you manage the time anyway.
Well, let's take one more question then.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I understand transmission issues for wind generation aren't the focus of the study, but were transmission lines studied and recommended in this piece of work by these experts? Where would I look at those?
Basically, that's Appendix A, which I think you have attached there, and lists the specific lines that were not studied, but we were told. And that chapter, by the way, does not, we didn't write any of that, except maybe in the first paragraph. It's pulled out of the MISO assumptions. And pretty much, not every single person, there's one didn't, but pretty much everybody on that technical review committee agreed that those were reasonable assumptions.
Thank you. So, Mr. Wolf, you want to proceed with the...
With that here, there's a reason, emphasize again, I'm done with the technical findings of the integrated study, which you directed the PUC to do. The first presentation you saw my name and Matt Sugar's name on it. This one you see only my name on it because it's my interpretation of the rate impact. The rate impact was directed to be done by the utilities. However, I felt that might be a kind of an important piece of all of this, and I worked with the utilities to try and come up with some reasonable assumptions as to how in the world we're going to translate this into rates for estimating purposes. And Xcel Energy came up with an incredibly simple approach. I said it's too easy, it can't be right. But the other utilities agree it's a good rough estimate, and the Department of Commerce agrees that it's a good rough estimate and about the best you can do at this point. Subject to when integrated resource plans come in, it will be subject to very rigorous analysis of the figures and the loads and everything else, and may at that point come up with a slightly different number. But there's pretty good consensus out there that this is a pretty good number. The charts and graphs are mine. I'm trying to take what they told me and put it in plain English, and I'll do that now. And this will be more clear once I show the graphs if you're looking ahead. But what the rate impact is, when we looked at wind, the wind is 15% or 20% or 25% of the whole energy. And so I'm told if you take that cost per megawatt hour of that 20% and spread it across 100%, you simply divide the cost by 5. Because 20 is one-fifth of 100. And if you're spreading 20% of that across 100%, it's dividing by 5. So at a 20% penetration rate, second bullet, the cost is whatever, those different numbers, at different years, at different penetrations, divided by a particular number. At 20%, you divide it by 5. So if you look at this graph or picture, the blue, including the red, encompassing all of that, is all energy consumed. That's the total sales for all utilities, for all users. The red was the either 15, 20, or 25%. And so the words in here, the integration cost for wind energy delivered, so the cost for that energy that we looked at, but spread it across that whole box. And you got a little table down here, so if you're looking at, let's take 20% first, that was the legislative directive, 20% is one-fifth of all energy consumed, so that's 20% of that box. And therefore, 20% rate is the cost, whatever costs are in those other charts, divided by 5. At 25%, you divide it by 4, and at 15%, you divide it by 6 and 2-thirds. It's shown on this slide. Now, this slide looks really busy. It's very, very simple. In the blue tells the things we studied. Across the top are the 15%. The first column is the lowest rate and the highest, or cost. I make that mistake myself. Then you look at the 20% range, low and high, and the 25% range, low and high. And the numbers on the next thing, and please pay attention to the red. As you read these things, it's very important. That red says dollars per megawatt hour. And the integration cost I took off the previous charts, $2.11 to $4.41. The rate impact is simply taking that cost in each of those columns, dividing it by line 2, which is the divisor, 6 and 2-thirds, 5 and 4. So the rate impact is $2.11. Cost is 32 cents, 0.32 dollars. The high is $1.10 per megawatt hour. And people, including me especially, get all twisted up when you try and translate this. People don't talk about how much they pay for their electric bill in megawatt hours. They talk about it in kilowatt, in cents per kilowatt hour, actually. So I just take you through two steps here. The second group of things, again, look, it's dollars per kilowatt hour. Kilowatt hours is 1,000 megawatt hours. You divide the first group by 1,000. Move the decimal point 3 places, and you get the second group of numbers. That's the dollars per kilowatt hour, so that 0.0021 is dollars. Now, if you look at your bill, you see you're interested in how much cents per kilowatt hour you do. So you just turn dollars into cents. Look at the heading in red, cents per kilowatt hour. So you see in the first number there, 0.21 cents. It's not 21 cents, it's 0.21 cents. Translates it into a rate impact of 0.03 cents, 0.03 of a cent. So from a low of 0.03 to 0.11. Now the next chart I will show you is, now you will hear, well, that's only so many cents per typical customer. Well, are you residential or are you industrial or whatever? If you're a residential customer, it's one thing. If it's a if it's a steel mill, it might be another thing. The adder is the same. The 0.03, the 0.04, the 0.05 is the same. So I don't like averages and stuff, because I don't know. But I looked at my bill. So this is the specific customer rate impact example. This is one individual that I happen to look at. And so I don't know if I'm a typical or average or big consumer or little consumer or waste energy or whatever. So remember that when you look at this. Again, across the top is the consistent. That's the penetration levels and the cost range. Flip to the footnote first. Down here, the customer annual average rate calculation. And again, I say this is a specific Dakota Electric residential customer.
Who shall remain unnamed.
Right. So I looked at my bill and I found something. I learned something new. I knew this once, but I forgot. I pay a standard rate of 7.25 cents. Again, please note the heading, cents. 7.25 cents per kilowatt hour standard rate. In the summer, I pay more. I pay 8.65 cents per kilowatt hour. I took 2006, added up my usage, 12,665 kilowatt hours at an average rate of $7.64. That's $7. See, I did it. At 7.64 cents per kilowatt hour. And I just carry that up to the second line there in the group under cents per kilowatt hour. So my average annual rate is 7.64 cents per kilowatt hour spread across the whole year. You take my total billing is the same across the line, $967.61. The next, the percent increase is, if you go up to the next one, 0.03 divided by 0.03 rate adder divided by my average rate, 7.64 cents, is 39%. You go over to the high, 11.11 cents added to 7.64 cents is 1.44%. 1.4% increase on the 967. So the impact of this study on my bill for the variability of wind ranges from $3.80 at 15% to $13.93 annual cost at the high end. And that's the end of my presentation.
Questions? I think we probably will, Mr. Wolf, ask you to come back at a later date.
Chair, I do have a question.
Bring your pacifier with you. And Representative Westrum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wolf, maybe this is more for Mr. Sugar, but did they factor in anything if the wind was distributed and more constant, if you could be collecting it aggregately? I know you talked some about the aggregate benefit, but was that contemplated much at all versus just having wind in one part of the state or one source? You follow what I'm asking?
I think I understand what you're asking. The answer is no, we didn't. And look at that.
Okay.
We only analyzed in depth exactly what we showed you here, wind towers at the locations I told you.
follow-up, Representative Western?
That's it.
Other questions? Representative Kayla?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The cost of transmission upgrade is not included in the study, correct?
That's correct.
And we need to do transportation, upgrade generally as well.
That's correct.
Is there a difference between the necessary transmission upgrades that need to happen and the transmission upgrades that will need to happen to integrate the increase in wind generation?
Mr. Wolf.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure, I think, and again, MISO can address this better, maybe the utilities today, but generally we use assumptions. I think, I don't want to speak for them, but the CapEx studies, which is most of what we're assuming, I remember them saying it's non-denominational, that to gather the resources, whether it's a coal plant in North Dakota or a wind farm on the ridge or whatever, we need a network of transmission, and I think what they came up with is fairly generic as far as bringing in a mix of resources, some wind, some other things, and bringing it in. To get any more specific than that, I need Matt Sugar.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalen.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples and not apples to key limes.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in essence, we are talking about the integration of increased wind capacity, and that the transmission upgrades are pretty much going to be, for our estimation, looking at the worst case scenario here, roughly 1.5% rate increase per your highly tuned calculations in terms of your own individual bill. But that we can assume that's a pretty stable number, roughly, and that the transmission upgrades are an independent cost that need to happen regardless.
I can't assume that based on this study, and you need to talk to other people about that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Appreciate it.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Wolf. We appreciate your coming in, and I'm sure we'll
be happy to
have you back.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have Mr. Garvey, who I saw here earlier and don't see now. There he is. Commissioner Garvey, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. The purpose of my being here is to give a very quick and relatively cursory overview of the generation needs for the state and background information of those needs, as well as, and perhaps more importantly, to set up the next presentation on the CapEx transmission line study. Electrical use is a demand-driven issue that, instead of electrons being pushed from the generator, it's actually being pulled by the user. And it's being pulled when every time you flip the switch, the demand for electricity goes on. Instantaneously, it's sent through the wires. The grid is then generated and electricity is provided. Very cursory point. So you need to have that completely and absolutely always synchronized. You need to have the generation capabilities there. You need to have the transmission lines there to meet the load, to meet the demand use. And what I've sort of handed out to you is a very quick packet of an overview of the generation from the U.S. Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration's website, I'm Minnesota. And it sort of basically talks very quickly, gives you a lot more information than we're going to talk about today. It gives you a lot more information that you may ever need, but it's actually very, very interesting and useful information to sit back and just go through these charts. You know, on the cover chart, and I have extra copies because I know there are others who probably want them. This sort of shows that we have, you know, our net summer, which is because we are a summer peaking. We have a summer peaking system. You know, we have basically a capability of the network of a little over 11.5 million megawatts. The total generation is 52 million megawatt hours. You know, and you see our comparisons across the state. You flip to page 2, and it sort of gives you some of the same numbers, but it gives you all the states. You see, again, I've underlined Minnesota because we're smack dab in the middle of our capacity. This is summer net generation. It gives you some emission numbers, but this gives you a sense of where we are compared to the other nation and the other states. Page 3 is a similar national look, but it's basically on retail sales, and this is in many respects useful for comparing Minnesota. If you notice that Minnesota, because we 100% of our pro retail sales are provided by full service sales entities, because we're not a retail choice state. But then the meat, and I think what Mr. Chairman, what you wanted me to talk about most specifically, I guess, is on page 4. And table 2, you know, gives you a quick snapshot of the largest electrical generation facilities in the state. These are not the only large generating facilities that serve the state. There are a number outside of the state. Manitoba Hydro, of course, is in Upper Manitoba. The Coal Creek facility is in central North Dakota. We do have some, XL has some generating facilities in Wisconsin. Most of these, we have the Big Stone facility, which of course is right across the border in South Dakota. We have a number of those kind of facilities that aren't listed here. But this is a quick sense of where you come. You have big facilities and then a lot of little facilities. A lot of little facilities are designed for various purposes. The big facilities are generally for baseload. Then you have intermediate facilities, and then you have peakers, which go on peak summer days, your July and August kinds of days. You have a whole series of different kinds of operators and owners of those facilities and generators. And the table 5 gives you a quick list. Of course, Anoka County Electric Co-op is now Conexus. But you sort of see that our three largest facilities, our three largest, are the investor-owned utilities. And then you see on page 5 a quick snapshot over the last sort of decade of the type of fuels that we use for our various electrical generation and who uses them. You see a different type of that snapshot on page 6. Where you break down into megawatt hours. This is one of those ones you need to always make sure you're talking about, whether you're talking about megawatts or megawatt hours. Megawatt hours is energy generated. Megawatt hours is the capacity of a facility for generating those megawatt hours. You see on page 6 sort of the fuel prices. Table 7 are the emissions over time. Table 8 shows the retail categories, residential, commercial, industrial, the types of uses, transportation. You see that. You see the retail rates, the average rates down there. And I can give you, you know, there's lots more of these kind of data on that. And then I've added, if you will, the last sort of 9, 7, pages 9 through 12 is an overview of energy in general. It brings into our natural gas, residential use, our petroleum usage. I mean, I just provide that because I think that keeping in perspective all of our energy usage is very, very helpful. And if not helpful in a specific context, it's helpful in the bigger context as we think about energy policy as we go forward. Mr. Chairman, I can go into a lot more detail to the extent that I can, and others can go in even more detail than I can on a lot of these kinds of questions. But the question that I think is really before the commission is going to be, before the committee, is our portfolio mix of resources, how they're fueled, where they come from, the prices of those. But the common denominator is going to be transmission. And we have identified this transmission question several years ago. And in many respects, it was this committee that was the sort of source where we actually sort of identified transmission as, in many respects, the Achilles heel to a lot of this issue and the need to address that issue, which is one of the reasons why we pass laws to encourage transmission being built. The reason you need transmission built is threefold. You need it for economic dispatch to make sure the most economic and best facilities are being providing electricity to the system. You need it for reliability. A stronger electrical grid promotes reliability, prevents blackouts, prevents brownouts, and it helps provide generation outlets for generation facilities that we want to come online more than anything, and that is many of our distributed wind generating facilities. So you need more transmission for those reasons. Building transmission is very hard. A question I think Representative Kalin asked was sort of the connection between the wind baseload and transmission. When you know where the baseload facility is being built, and you know that point A, and you know its load is point B, it's a much easier grid management issue, grid construction question, than when you basically are sort of saying, here's where we think a whole series of windmills are going to go. And so you need to, we're in a transition period that you need to not only stabilize the backbone of the grid to manage and meet our growing electrical demands, but you also are changing our resource needs in ways that also need to address that. And it's a dynamic system. It's a very complicated system. So when you hear the utilities and intersects ask and sort of say they're sensitive to this kind of question, they're actually thinking about that dynamic point. And it's a legitimate point that we need to always be mindful of, because the grid is very, very important, that interconnection between the generation facility, the grid, and the user. So, Mr. Chairman, I think I hope I've addressed at least a little bit of what you expected out of this as a transition from the wind integration study, a little quick overview of where we're getting our generation from, but more importantly, sort of the transition to a discussion on transmission in the CapEx presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think there's a lot more detail that we'd like to get into at some point, but I thought that this might be helpful as a kind of a lead-in to the CapEx question. I think we do have one question from Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, Commissioner Garvey, you mentioned that the transmission needed for three reasons in the generation facilities, and then you mentioned the distributed generation desire or idea, maybe CBET. How much would that be? Would it be like the 115 kilovolts and under? Or, you know, okay, I guess the scenario is where it might be available already, maybe space without building transmission. What if the capacity factor in those areas is hard to finance? Would the feed-in or CBET or feed-in tariff, if you will, be negotiated at a higher than in the statute rate, potentially? I mean, or would you go to another technology that's not wind? You know, you see what I mean, tying it where transmission is available might not be the best place to put a turbine.
Commissioner Garvin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, when I first said we need new transmission, we need it's not all the same kind of transmission that we
right.
need. We need transmission for economic dispatch, for grid reliability, and for availability from our wind-producing areas.
Mm-hmm.
Those may be different types of transmission in different kilovolt standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I understand your question, is you need to build the transmission line to where the wind is best. And it's as much about, and then once you build one line, it opens up capacity elsewhere because they're all completely interconnected. And the electrons will flow in a way where it's path of least resistance kind of thing. So building a line in southeastern Minnesota may have a very beneficial effect in allowing wind off of the southwestern Minnesota because it frees up lines coming out of actually South Dakota and Nebraska. And that's actually a very important question that you might want to ask MISO, how the regionality plays into effect. So, I mean, my message is that we need transmission at all levels in many different places of the state. And that's actually what the CapEx folks are working on, and that's actually what the transmission plans that we're working with the utilities are doing. I don't think I directly answered your question,
okay.
But that's because I didn't completely understand it.
Well, it goes back to our history. I know, I'm just saying, we're running short on time. We can talk later.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kalin, if you have a brief question, because we are getting short on time.
Yeah, very brief. Just, the transmission grid is regional. It's not state by state. And the three major plants that don't show up on our list that are part of our regional network that you referenced, Manitoba Hydro, Coal Creek, and Big Stone, if you could just throw some numbers at us in terms of capacity of each of those so we have those in our mind when we're making these considerations.
Yeah, you know, I was worried you were not going to ask that.
I saw that look on your face, so I thought I'd
ask
you. You know, I think the Manitoba Hydro, actually, can I get adult supervision, Mr. Chairman, very quickly? Mariah? Mr. Chairman, the person that's walking down is Mariah West. She's been the manager of the department's energy advocacy and policy development for many, many years, and is in many respects the foundation of all the knowledge that I have. And if you ever really want a firm answer to a question, I strongly urge the committee or many members to ask for Mariah White.
With that introduction, Ms. White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Manitoba Hydro actually is a very large series of dams in Upper Manitoba. What comes into Minnesota specifically is approximately 500 megawatts, and that is approximately the capacity of the line that is coming from Manitoba into Minnesota into approximately the center or the Twin Cities part of the state. Right now that line is at peak times running about at capacity. So that is about what we can get, maybe not at every day of the year, but overall we are running at about capacity coming from Manitoba. Manitoba has plans and is working with the First Nations in Manitoba to develop one or two new series of dams, on the upper part of even farther north on Manitoba that will make available a lot more megawatts. But at that point, if we wish to, in the future, if we wish to partake of any part of those or significant part of those future megawatts, we would again be looking at transmission coming out of Manitoba. I think that the CapEx folks, I'm looking at Terry, are having that in mind. It's not a specific part of at least the first group of transmission lines the CapEx is anticipating, but it is farther on their, it's farther down on their radar screen. So that's Manitoba. Coal Creek has approximately 600 megawatts that are coming out of North Dakota. That is only Coal Creek. There are a number of baseload coal plants in North Dakota that are operated by different utilities that at times provide energy to Minnesota depending on, again, the day, the temperature, the load forecast. There are other plants operated. Otter Tail Power has a part ownership of the Coyote plant. There are the co-ops. GRE has other plants, coal plants in North Dakota. That part of the energy is coming into Minnesota as well. Big Stone Plant Unit 1 right now is 600 megawatts. That is delivering power to parts of South Dakota, Minnesota, at times North Dakota. It is taking care of that part of the grid, and that is owned by Otter Tail Power, other regulated utilities in other states, as well as part ownership in by cooperatives and municipal power agencies.
Representative Kalin, is it safe to assume I've answered your question?
Indeed, and I'll just like to point out, Mr. Chair, that the question was short, but the answer was comprehensive. Thank you.
I apologize.
No, quite comprehensive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think at this point we will call on Mr. Groves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of the CapEx today. I'm Terry Grove. I'm co-director with Laura McCartan, who is also here at the CapEx initiative. If time permits, I hope to step quickly through a PowerPoint presentation of which you also have in your packet, and there's also a single sheet in your packet.
If we run over a little bit, Mr. Grove, I think we can give you about 15 minutes, is that?
I will pick up the pace. A potential place where we can cut some corners is we had got some feedback, if you look at the testimony overview, that there might be some interest in sort of a little bit of background for those new to energy issues on regional transmission and how transmission fits in, and the regional entities such as MISO and Deputy Commissioner Garvey and Mr. Wolf gave excellent answers on those, so perhaps we can set those aside, and it sounds like you may have MISO representatives back at some point.
We would expect to do that, yes.
In skipping over those, then, I'll get quickly to some background on the CapEx 2020 Transmission Initiative, talk a little bit about the projects we are pursuing now, and then perhaps of most interest to the committee members, our perspectives on some of the issues that will come into play if a higher renewable energy objective or standard is put in place, and our view of some conclusions that are implied by that. This is material I'll skip, and I'll be happy to answer questions. Deputy Commissioner Garvey gave an excellent summary of why bulk transmission is important, and really all our comments today go to the bulk transmission system, the stuff shown in the middle of the pictorial. I think I will skip over the Midwest ISO and only respond to questions, and it sounds like you may have them back again. The Midwest ISO is one of several regional entities, and here's a little bit better view of their footprint, and I'll skip the other points on that. This I will cover very briefly. The Midwest ISO is very relevant to what CapEx is doing and vice versa. They have several missions. They are the, if you will, traffic cop of the bulk transmission system. They ensure reliability and security on a minute-by-minute basis and up to a planning-type time frame. And they don't actually push the buttons that operate the system, but they monitor the system and they direct the operating utilities to take actions to keep the system secure, and they do that with a big picture view of their entire footprint. As other committee members observed, they're heavily involved in planning the transmission system, particularly interregional and interstate planning, and the planning that's needed to connect new generators and provide transmission service for them. They also administer a transmission tariff that provides open and non-discriminatory access to the transmission system. And finally, they operate a regional energy market and try to minimize congestion. Congestion being backups of power when too much power is trying to flow from generation to a particular load and the transmission system can't accommodate it. Moving on to CapEx, of who we are and what we're trying to do. Many of you are aware it started in 2004 as the utilities that serve Minnesota customers looked ahead and saw some needs coming. The needs were primarily to provide a reliable source of electricity to those customers, ensure reliability, as Deputy Commissioner Farabee mentioned. We knew that we were facing a lot of load growth in the coming years. There had been very, very strong growth in customer demand and the belief that that would continue, and that was going to stress the transmission system a lot. And finally, although we didn't know the path it would take, we surmised that there would be increased interest in renewable energy and perhaps other sources of generation, and wanted to make sure we were planning and building a transmission system that accommodated that. Although the utilities have always worked closely together, I think we're rather unique. It's a very strong consortium of utilities. It involves cooperatives, municipal utilities, and all investor-owned utilities that serve Minnesota customers. The first act of the CapEx consortium was to take what we knew at that time, and starting in 2004, and this vice progressed through 2005, even 2006, and create a high-level conceptual plan that we thought would satisfy the objectives that I mentioned earlier. And this high-level conceptual plan is to make sure that you're building in such a way that the pieces will ultimately fit together and that you will meet all the needs. And it was a plan not simply to cover Minnesota, but the other parts of the service territory of those transmission providers, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, and to integrate well with the other plans being proposed that primarily serve those areas. It was intended to take a very long-range view out to 2020 in order to make sure that you didn't sub-optimize it by building temporary Band-Aid-type solutions that ultimately didn't turn out to be used and useful over the long term. As I mentioned, it may not look impressive, but 2.5% or so is a very high growth rate as compared to other utilities in other areas of the country. And at the time, we were looking at the objective that was in place for the utilities of 10% renewable energy penetration by 2010, and it certainly looks like that will be much more aggressive. I'll skip over this. It shows the breadth of the utilities that are involved. From the high-level conceptual plan, the initial vision plan, isn't the kind of plan you can go out and build facilities from. It's not sufficient to permit facilities. It's not detailed enough to build them. You're not sure those are the exact facilities you want to build. So from the vision plan, there were very much more detailed and rigorous planning conducted. And the results of that planning gave us the initial projects that are highlighted there, the Group 1 projects. And their distinguishing characteristic is they are all needed to ensure reliability for Minnesota customers. They also integrate very well with the regional plans. And most importantly, they're a building block to whatever kind of generation is built, whether that's renewable generation, conventional sources, and they're useful primarily wherever it is built. As others have stated, Mariah, for instance, beyond that, it gets a little foggier, and those plans are under development. I'll talk more about that. But a key driver for them is what resources are going to be put in place. We'll always strive to get plans with the most flexibility, but the plans will depend a lot on whether resources are located in Manitoba Hydro, whether there's a higher renewable energy objective, and where those resources are ultimately located. So beyond the Group 1 projects, which are, then we're moving into the range of what are now conceptual plans, it's thought that there'll be a large reliability-based development around the Twin Cities, and around is a little bit uncertain at this point. It may go far to the west, depending on renewable generation. And then there would be individual developments, long spokes, if you will, reaching out to remote generation, whether that it continues to be on the Buffalo Ridge area, Minnesota, in the Dakotas, and Manitoba Hydro. And at those points, those are conceptual plans. Many of you heard that the four Group 1 projects alone are estimated to cost $1.3 billion. Those are indicative estimates at this time. We're only beginning the permitting process. We don't have routes. Very large projects, 600 miles or more, primarily 345 kV line, and a lot of development of large new substations and enhancements to the underlying lower voltage system.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beard.
Mr. Grove, those 600 miles of new lines, are they in existing right-of-ways? Are they going to be upgrading them as existing lines, or is this brand-new purchase, brand-new condemnation, that whole ball of wax?
Mr. Grove.
It'll be a mix. We're required by statute, and the utilities always seek to use existing corridors whenever they can. Mm-hmm. There'll be some areas as we go through the routing process where, under the authority of the PUC, they say the overall best decision is to use a new corridor, and in that case, we'd have to procure new right-of-way.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hoffman.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Grove.
This may go somewhat to the last question too. Shown in this pictorial are the large corridors where we will give public notice to landowners and local government units for each of those. The so-called notice corridors have been defined in proceedings we've been through with the Public Utilities Commission, and I think the pictorial shows you the breadth of even the four Group 1 projects. These projects are for reliability. They work together. It's not possible to choose individual ones and get the same benefit. When they were designed to enable some amount of renewable energy, 1,000 megawatts or more, primarily off the Buffalo Ridge, and I should say southwest Minnesota area. And they are will be useful however generation develops, and I guess also they're just needed for reliability. There, it'll be a very long process. The Minnesota state need and routing process and the related federal processes and processes for the small portions in other states will take, we expect, 3 to 5 years to complete. There'll be multi-year construction process that follows the end of the routing process. Moving on from the Group 1 projects, we've done, of course, some thinking and analysis of what it might mean as far as new transmission for a larger amounts of renewables. We have to take the plans that exist now that were somewhat described by Mr. Wolf, and we have to do the kind of detailed studies to figure out which projects we would actually build and make sure those integrate well with needs in other states and the regions. First and foremost, they have to reflect whatever the legislature chooses to do with a renewable portfolio standard or objective. Individual utilities then will take the guidance provided by the legislature and the regulatory agencies and line up new sources of supply. And it's sort of a chicken and egg problem, as was described. It's hard to build transmission that's flexible enough for any range of supply options. And so we need that input, and we'll be working with those to make those decisions. And finally, the plan needs to be well coordinated with the Midwest Independent System Operator to make sure it integrates well with plans in other areas and the regional plans. It's a big task not only in planning, but you would have that same sort of permitting timeline and hurdles that the Group 1 projects will soon be into, multi-state review, federal review, and as the utilities, we want to spend a lot of time working with the stakeholders, local government, others along the potential routes, landowners, and as you start doing that in more and more forums on top of approximately 600 miles of Group 1 projects, that becomes a little daunting to us. One trend we're seeing from the industry side is, it's a little surprising and even a little sobering, is the CapEx Group 1 projects aren't particularly large transmission projects when you take those in a national perspective. There's very, very large transmission projects being proposed in, as far as I know, all regions of the country. It's already becoming apparent those are going to put a lot of stress on the skilled labor to build them, and even materials when we get that far, and the utilities need to develop strategies in order to make sure that we can actually build these when we get that far. There are other constraints in the interest of time. I won't go into those, but it goes to the question of right-of-way. Many times we'll be overbuilding existing right-of-way, which in turn imposes constraints about when you can do it and how you can do it. So it's going to be a bit of a juggling act trying to get more projects built in conjunction with the Group 1 projects.
Representative McGinnis.
It seems to me you're getting ready to go into your conclusions, and I would like to go back and look at your assumption of a 2.47% growth rate annually. And in Minnesota, we have, and in this region, we have not talked about carbon dioxide. It's been kind of an off-the-table issue, and now people are chattering all over the place about it, including our constituents. It's just like bubbled up. So, did you look at carbon dioxide when you made that assumption in growth rate and global warming and what we need to do to respond to that?
I don't believe that they looked explicitly at carbon dioxide. They looked at historical trends and economic-based load forecasts. We do expect that in the regulatory proceedings we'll be fully asked to prove that these projects still make sense at a variety of growth rates, conceivably lower ones. But I guess it's sort of a non-answer, but I don't believe that they looked at carbon scenarios in computing those.
Representative Wiggins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, before you go to conclusions, I think I can't draw any conclusions until we revisit that growth assumption, considering that we all know that we have to take major steps now, and there's no more pretending that we are going to be talking about those issues. So I'm a little skeptical of conclusions without the carbon built there. That's it.
If I understand your point correctly, I think it is. There's more emphasis potentially on demand side management and conservation. Those to minimize carbon dioxide emissions. Those assumptions will have to be factored into the growth rate that we take to the regulators to justify the projects. And whether those are adequately considered or not, that's what we've used thus far. But I think we're really going to be put through a rigorous process to find an appropriate rate of growth for our load forecast.
And Mr. Grove, we will have to ask you to conclude today, but hopefully we can have you back sometime soon, perhaps in conjunction with the MISO presentation. Sorry for the time management that didn't allow you as much time as I'm sure we would have liked for you to have. But if you could conclude, we'll make sure that you get an opportunity to give us a fuller presentation at a later date.
Well, thank you. Do you want any further remarks, or do you need to terminate the session now?
If you do have concluding remarks, and I see that you do in your presentation have a page called Conclusions, you could go to that briefly.
The first page of Conclusions is, I believe, relatively straightforward, and I'll summarize it the best I can. We need to do a lot more planning. We need to do that with the utilities, the Midwest ISO, other states, and we want to do that, and it builds on our strengths, and we're prepared and able to do so. The point I'd like to leave you on with the second slide of Conclusions, though, is from the CapEx utility side, we do have some concerns about 20 to 25% renewables and the ability of transmission to support them. The policy decisions will be what they may. We're not entirely sure that we can get there on transmission. We're out to make the best effort we can, but want to raise a bit of a flag with legislators in that we don't know a lot about what those projects will involve yet. As Mr. Wolf said, the wind integration study needed to make some assumptions about the transmission that would exist in the far future, and they did so, and they got input on that, and it's not a flaw of the study, but many of those assumptions it made on transmission were from high-level conceptual studies, including lines that are out of the CapEx area and the Dakotas and Iowa and Wisconsin, and those aren't agreed-to plans or there isn't enough analysis to show that's what should be built. And so we want to raise a bit of a flag of caution that transmission is not an insignificant issue. We're out to, as the CapEx utilities, we feel we have a good framework for working through that and suggesting good options, and we'll do so. But perhaps when we have more time or in conjunction with the MISO, we could go over that just a bit more.
Thank you. We'll try to squeeze in a couple of questions. We have Representative Peterson and then Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the wind integration study, the PowerPoint that's on the web, it's a summary, sufficient transmission. And then your conclusions say transmission is assumed, is only conceptual, wind integration study. So then were the transmission assumptions agreed to by the participants of the wind integration study?
I would probably defer to Mr. Wolf, but my understanding is the people involved in that said these are valid assumptions, but it really comes down to they were very much assumptions. I'd point you to a single sheet you have in your packet that you can review. We tried to characterize projects as either relatively firm or highly conceptual, and you'll see a line down about two-thirds of the way down that spreadsheet. Some very significant projects are still at the conceptual stage. I don't think that's a flaw of the wind integration study. It just introduces some challenges of how you would get adequate transmission.
Follow-up. Then would you agree or disagree that you're used to meeting aggressive timelines for transmission as directed? I mean, for instance, the planning for Big Stone 2 seems to be very aggressive. Okay, that's coal. Would it be as aggressive if it was renewable? And aren't you used to, and didn't MISO already complete a vision plan that looks at a 20% energy standard over the footprint? I believe they did. And then a 10% from 20% for Minnesota, and then 10% for the rest of the MISO footprint. So, I think everybody talks about transmission. It's the first thing that people say is that we're going to need all this transmission. I haven't found anybody who can keep talking about why or show it written down for more than 10 to 15 minutes as to why. I mean, it seems like the first thing you guys say is that we need all this transmission and we can't do it, but when you got this proposal for Big Stone 2, boy, it's really aggressive. So just to, you know, if it's the source of the power that's the problem, you should just say that.
I don't believe that that's the case at all, in that Mr. Wolf used the phrase non-denominational, and CapEx is out to build the transmission for whatever resources are needed, not more aggressively for coal than wind. Whatever the policy decisions and resource decisions dictate, we will build that. Fixed-Stone had an advantage in transmission. It was a very well-defined resource, and it was near the Minnesota border, and much of the transmission was in Minnesota. As you start talking about larger resources with uncertainty around them that require transmission both in Minnesota and outside our border, it becomes a more complex problem. Not an unreasonable problem, but more complex, and that's one of the issues we wanted to highlight.
Mike, just a comment to the members of the committee as we contemplate these things, and it was along the same lines that Representative Peterson brought up, except a little different. In the wind integration study, first of all, I was pleased that it looked so hopeful that perhaps this is doable, but I think the commissioner was pretty clear that it assumed the CapEx 2020 plan, which doesn't, as we see now, CapEx 2020 plan doesn't include everything that is going to be needed for a 20 or 25% wind integration. That we don't know those numbers, and as we go forward, I'm looking forward to hearing what that's going to be. But the CapEx 2020 stuff, which was assumed, is going to be built anyhow, regardless of 10%, 25%, or nothing, in Mr. Wolf's presentation, as it turns out, doesn't include all the costs that we may need to consider. I don't know that those are going to be budget busters, but they are costs we're going to have to pay attention to, and so we should go in with our eyes wide open. So it really wasn't a question, Mr. Chair, just an observation. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, thank you for your patience and going a little bit long today. We'll try to keep that under control in the future. On Monday, we will be hearing from the Department of Commerce an overview of their activities, and particularly as it affects our accounts. Unless there are questions or comments, the meeting is adjourned.
We'll leave it.